really snow equals money, and more of it is more money, and less of it is less money.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Ski season is in full swing, but while skiers are riding the lifts and swishing down the slopes as usual, the ski industry is undergoing major changes, everything from the gear to who participates in the sport. This time we'll hear about how the ski industry is preparing for the future. There's no doubt skiing can be a very expensive sport, and now there's a concern that mergers and acquisitions could make it even pricier. So is it increasingly a sport just for the wealthy? To ask that question, the Mountain West News Bureau visited a couple of very different places, Bogus Basin in Idaho and Jackson Hole Mountain Resort in Wyoming. Camila Kudelska takes us there.
The mountain draws visitors from all over the world. Lift tickets here average $140 a day, and staying at the village can cost anywhere from $300 to $2,000 a night. The village is pretty glitzy with boutique shops and upscale restaurants, but ask Jackson Hole's Anna Cole, and she'll tell you the mountain has built its reputation on serious skiing.
This mountain is unlike any others you'll ever experience.
Lots of steep and deep runs, she says. I decide to give it a try. Trey Sharp is my guide. As we ride up the Bridger Gondola, he tells me he grew up in Jackson Hole. This mountain isn't for the faint of heart.
You have exposed cliff bands, and you have some danger. It instills a bit more of the sense of adventure, or it keeps it fresh instead of someplace that's completely pampered.
Sharp takes me on the aerial tramway. We go up 4,000 vertical feet.
If you are considering going into the backcountry, please have all of your proper equipment, knowledge, partner, gear, plan. And if you don't know, don't go.
Sharp leads me to the legendary Corbett's Couloir shoot run.
It's like dropping into, say, a half pipe. You know, it's vertical at the top and one very committing turn.
My stomach flips. Thankfully, it's closed, and we ski down another less scary black diamond. At the base, we head to a popular restaurant for an après-ski. We both opt for a $19 twisted Reuben.
And you know that's made with salmon, right?
You do.
Perfect. I double-check. Some people miss that.
This is a feeling Jackson Hole says it wants you to have. Feeling accomplished after a full day of skiing and then on to enjoy the village with friends. I'm Camila Kudelska in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
And I'm James Dawson in Bogus Basin, Idaho.
1, 2, 3.
No village, fancy restaurants, or five-star hotels here. Most families drive in for the day. 8-year-old twins Scarlett and Vivian have been skiing at Bogus since they were toddlers.
I love all the jumps, the ends, there's in the secret caves and the passages.
The ski area is one of just a handful of nonprofits in the country. Its operating budget is about $8.3 million, and they get about 340,000 visitors in the winter, mostly locals. Scarlett and Vivian's parents had their first date there.
He was like the classic hot guy out of the 90s.
That classic hot guy here is Pat, and he's been skiing at Bogus since he was 6.
I remember driving up the road in the back of the station wagon. My mom driving and having to listen to my sister's music.
You know, the classics like Madonna, The Cure, maybe throwing a little Scorpions. He skied a lot of places, but the vibe there keeps him going back.
All my friends that I grew up with in the 80s and 90s that we grew up skiing together, we now have our kids, and our kids are getting up there. There's just such a tradition of the love of skiing.
Suzanne says she loves the Bogus vibe too, but the vibes at swanky resorts like Aspen, not so much.
Get out of the car and you're like, everybody's got mascara and the fancy outfit. And the thing about Bogus is, like, the most beautiful, you know, stylish women here will just be like, I woke up and put my beanie on and we're gonna go have some fun. And I love that.
The next day, I meet the family at Bogus for lunch, sandwiches and fries served on olive green cafeteria trays. Pat's friend Jesse Weiss is joining us as well. He's been a ski instructor at Bogus and Jackson Hole and says they're completely different.
What they say about Jackson is the locals are better than the pros. So Jackson has a much more serious vibe. Here, it's about being rad and having fun.
And that's part of how Bogus Basin officials try to stand out. A day pass here is less than half the price of Jackson Hole and roughly a third of the price of a day pass at Vail. And the low prices and new summer programs may be working. From 2014 to 2017, attendance has nearly doubled. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm James Dawson.
In 2018, the Jackson Hole Mountain Resort underwent a change in leadership. Before Jerry Bland stepped down as president of the resort last May, he sat down with Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck to discuss how his vision to make the ski area a destination spot became a reality.
In 1995, Teton Village and Jackson Hole Mountain Resort looked a whole lot different. And so the ability to take a look and look at a piece of coal and make it into a diamond was really the goal. And we didn't know how that route was going to be pursued, but we knew it wasn't going to be a straight line. You know, it took a long period of time when you look back, and almost 23 years by the time I departed at the end of May. I guess people that would come in five-year chunks would see major, major improvements, and that's true. Of course, the biggest one was the replacement of the tram that took place from 2006 to 2008, which was kind of the cornerstone of about a $200 million total capital improvement project that's taken place over that period of time. So,
what turned? What maybe changed things so you could actually move forward and have some success?
Understanding that Teton Village is in an unincorporated area in Teton County, what we needed was a governance, a body to really oversee a lot of the mitigation strategies and a lot of the things that were put in place as conditions of approval of the master plan back in 98. So we put together a Teton Village Association, which is a special district, and we added a Teton Village Resort District, which took special statutory authority over in Cheyenne, which we were taking a few legislative sessions to accomplish that goal. But basically, it was a super district that allowed a sales tax charge in the village core, basically to reinvest in the infrastructure, similar to a town. A village resort governance model that allows us to compete on a relative basis to, you know, other destinations. I always like to say that allowed us to get up off our knees and start to walk a little bit. And you know, that's been acknowledged. Ski Magazine rated us number one a few years ago. Forbes has rated us first number one for the last 7 years. So we're being readily acknowledged as a resort that is at the top. And hand in hand with that goes a very guest-centric approach to how we approach all of our visitors.
You know, and you talk a little bit about that, and again, we're talking with Jerry Bland. You talk a little bit about this, the ski portion of it, which is the thing that you've always focused on, but as I recall our conversations in the past, it was also about making it a year-round destination. And what changed there? What was maybe the big key to making that happen? Was it the legislation in Congress that allowed you to do some extra things?
So that's a great question, and for those people that know Teton County is primarily summer focused, and Jackson Hole Mountain Resort and Teton Village is primarily winter focused, and so we were counter cyclical with everything virtually in our county, and so that allowed us to really go out and, in our case, go strong at winter. And in summer, we're very concerned about the impacts of tourists and tourism generally, with 4.5 to 5 million people coming through to visit the parks. But in the winter, it's much fewer. It's, you know, 80,000 to 100,000 people who stay 5 days on 5 to 6 days on average, and who spend individually much more on a daily basis than the summer visitors. So it's allowed over those years to create a balance. So the more we grow in the winter, it more equalizes our seasonality in terms of fiscal community-wide business levels. So with all the people coming through the valley, what we've really focused on is to try to keep and to add some activities on the mountain, such as the Via Ferrata, which we added this last year. We've got great mountain bike parks and trails and great walking trails on the mountain. A lot of other activities, tram riders, we did 140,000 plus riders last summer on the tram. So what we try to do is Bed Base here in Teton Village really supports a lot of the park activity in the summer, but we are really trying to reach out for those people and say, hey, stay a day in Teton Village and take advantage of the amenities right here in the village. And that's worked very well.
Jerry Bland, again, is the president of the Jackson Hole Mountain Resort, who's going to be wrapping up his tenure in that job and hopefully hit the ski slopes that you built up once in a while. Jerry, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bob, it's been a pleasure. Good talking to you.
Today, companies are using technology to make bombing down a cold mountain faster, more fun, and way more comfortable. That's changing what used to be a pretty basic sport. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie explains what's gained and what's lost with all of this new tech.
We're in a bustling ski factory west of the snowy Wasatch Mountains in Utah. Many of the workers here look like ski bums. We're talking beanies, beards, flannels, but they're hard at work crafting some of the most advanced skis in the world. I watch as wood and carbon fiber are smushed together in a giant red hot box.
Okay, so this is like the panini press for your ski sandwiches.
It is, yeah. I recommend not eating these, but but yes.
That last voice belongs to Alex Hunt. He's the communications manager here at DPS Skis, and he says carbon fiber skis are a fairly new trend. It's the same stuff companies use to make modern hockey sticks or racing bikes out of. It's flexible, durable, and really lightweight.
If it's lighter, the skier is going to use less energy and then therefore can take more runs because they're not so tired and just have a better day.
But they're also expensive. We're talking more than $1,000. Hunt compares these high-end skis to purchasing a new car.
You know, a Cadillac per se versus kind of a low-end kind of entry, Chevy or Pontiac or whatever's out there these days.
And just like new cars, skiing is getting more and more high-tech. For instance, there are goggles that show your text messages as they come in. Wearable tech that you can put in your boots to tell you if you're edging correctly. For novices out there, edging means how good or bad your technique is. And of course, for a while, you've been able to buy USB rechargeable heated gloves, boots, and jackets. Hunt says it all makes sense.
Going outside in the middle of winter for most people is not a pleasurable experience. So, you know, by having, you know, the best equipment, you know, having warm gloves, having, you know, good goggles so you have strong vision, you know, reduces all those negative things that come to mind when a lot of people think about, you know, going outside in a blizzard.
But being in a blizzard, bombing down a hill, wearing jeans and a cheap pair of gloves, that's how a lot of people out west used to ski. James Lynch is the outdoor gear editor for Popular Mechanics. And don't get him wrong, he loves a lot of this high-tech stuff. But Lynch also feels it kind of takes away from the struggle.
You know, the aspect of going outside into the outdoors and it not being comfortable.
In the olden days, he says, mountaineers and skiers, they look tough as nails.
You lose a little bit of that break the West kind of vibe that for a lot of time has been part of the outdoor adventure. The, you know, pushing yourself and seeing what you're capable of and having fun in that struggle.
But some people don't want to freeze their butts off on a mountain, or they want to go as fast as humanly possible down one, and they're willing to spend the money to do so. One market analyst group expects the ski equipment industry will be worth more than $5 billion by 2020. There's new products coming out constantly. Back at the ski factory, Alex Hunt shows off one of his company's newest inventions. It's called Phantom, and it looks like, well, clear goop.
I guess we could maybe compare it to the feel that you would get from like a vegetable oil.
Phantom costs around $100, but rub some on your skis, put them into a tanning bed, one for skis, not people, and you'll never have to buy wax again. Those skis, Hunt says, will go fast season after season. I ask him why people would spend that much money on stuff like this.
I think in general, there has been kind of a trend towards, I guess, more enjoyment and fulfillment in people's lives.
Nowadays, some people just want to have a little extra fun with their money.
And if that means, you know, spending some of that money on, you know, on more or less like toys.
Well, then that's good for Hunt's business and good for the ski hill. And talking about the ski hill, you might not even need one in the future. There are now virtual reality ski simulators in Los Angeles in Germany. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Salt Lake City, Utah.
In the Western states, the ski industry is an important economic driver, but it's facing a lot of changes. And probably the biggest one is climate. Winters are getting warmer and shorter, and mountain resorts are having to adapt. The Mountain West News Bureau's Ali Budner reports.
On a hot day back in September, I visited Arapahoe Basin ski area, just 80 miles west of Denver.
We got Dad and kiddo over here playing Frisbee.
The resort's Mike Nathan is giving me a tour. As we walk, Nathan points to a couple of kids running through a sprinkler.
I guarantee you that's a first for A-Basin. Kids shirtless playing in water in September at almost 11,000 feet.
Oh, and that German music in the background?
Today's our first ever Oktoberfest here at A-Basin.
Nathan says it's been a summer of firsts for this small ski area.
It's the first summer that we've had true, like, events every weekend.
He says they've drawn more people up this summer for hiking, mountain biking, and wildlife viewing. On the day I visited, the gold-leafed aspens were an attraction, in addition to the Biersteins and Strudel, of course. Nathan says this summer expansion was a natural way of growing their business and bolstering their annual income, using infrastructure they already had.
We think we've got such a cool place here that we really want to try to encourage people to use it all year round.
But the move is also related to shrinking winters. A recent report funded by the Environmental Protection Agency said if our current warming trend stays on course, nearly all ski areas in the country will see their winter recreation season shorten by a lot, 50% by 2050 and a whopping 80% by 2090. That's a problem for the ski industry. Tori Udall is with the Boulder-based nonprofit advocacy group Protect Our Winters.
Really, snow equals money, and more of it is more money, and less of it is less money.
According to the Outdoor Industry Association, snow sports contribute over $17 billion and more than 170,000 jobs to the economy. And that's in our region alone. Earlier this year, Udall's group published its own economic report.
During low snowfall years, the average number of jobs lost across the country is over 17,000, and the average revenue loss is just over $1 billion.
Of course, weather and snow seasons can vary quite a bit. In response to a question on preparing for climate change, a representative from Vail Resorts said they're not too worried. They're having a really good snow year. And that's true. Chris Linsmeyer is with Colorado Ski Country USA, an industry group that represents 23 ski areas in Colorado.
This year, we've had plentiful early season snowfall.
But, he says, it's important to note that over the long term, the mountains have been seeing more frost-free days.
Which has a huge impact on our industry, especially in the early season as resorts are utilizing man-made snow and working to get the resorts open. That's certainly a trend that we've seen.
And it's a trend the ski industry can't ignore.
Climate change is certainly something that our resorts are seeing affecting their business and are taking seriously and trying to come up with solutions to it.
Small resorts like Arapahoe Basin and big ones like Aspen.
We actually debuted our newest summer activity center up on Snowmass this summer. It's called Lost Forest.
That's Christian Knapp with the Aspen Skiing Company.
And we've got several cool activities built into the forest up there for families to enjoy. There's an alpine coaster up there. We've got a giant rock climbing wall. And we've really continued to build out our mountain bike downhill program as well.
But he says Aspen is also focusing on how to make and keep more snow on their slopes for the fall, winter, and spring.
We are investing in more snowmaking, coverage, pipelines, holding ponds, more brushing on the mountains so you can open with less snow, all those things. We want to be prepared going forward.
Back at Arapahoe Basin, Mike Nathan says they're preparing that way too. And he says while summer offerings aren't a silver bullet, it will definitely help their bottom line.
We've been very pleasantly surprised with the numbers we're getting, but to compare them to our winter visitation is it's apples and oranges, totally.
Their bread and butter, you could say, is still in the powder.
As the ski industry deals with the effects of climate change, it's turning ski resort leaders into activists and lobbyists. Ali Budner has that story.
Earlier this year, Aspen Skiing Company launched an edgy ad campaign called Give a Flake. A music video shows action shots of skiers and snowboarders shredding up mountains, while bright red letters in all caps flash across the screen, saying things like, if you love powder days, protect your passion, respect the mountain, join the movement. Christian Knapp is the head of marketing and sales for Aspen. He says they're trying to make people aware that climate change is affecting the industry. Then they're giving them tools to get involved.
There's a really cool Twitter widget where you can go in and put in your zip code, and it will pull up your
state senators and representatives.
The app shows the user how those politicians have voted when it comes to climate issues.
So you can see if they give a flake or if they don't, and then you can choose to generate a tweet at them.
And for the non-digitally inclined, Aspen printed ads in outdoor sports magazines that are actually postcards.
That you can tear out, sign, and drop in a post office box and send directly to three Republican senators who are really swing votes on climate.
Aspen is also working with the Boulder-based nonprofit advocacy group Protect Our Winters, or POW as it's known. A couple years ago, POW hauled a 1970s-era phone booth to the base of Aspen Mountain.
And had people calling their elected officials to urge them to protect the methane rule that was up for a vote in the Senate.
That's Tori Udall with POW.
Many of the people had never called an elected official on any issue, and especially not on climate.
Udall says offering people easy advocacy opportunities when they come to a ski resort is key to building a movement of people who care. And they're not stopping there. Recently, POW took Aspen's Mr. Knapp to Washington. Knapp spoke to us from inside the halls of Congress on what turned out to be a historic day. Kavanaugh was testifying in his bid to become a Supreme Court justice.
So it was a lot of buzz in the Capitol, a lot of energy here.
About 30 other members of the snow sports community were there too, from ski resort representatives and gear brand owners to Olympic athletes.
We had some great meetings with some of the senators and representatives and both sides of the aisle, talking to them about climate legislation that can help our future in the snow sports industry.
Going to D.C. isn't for everyone, though. Mike Nathan is the sustainability manager at Arapahoe Basin, or A-Basin as it's called. It's a small ski area 80 miles west of Denver. He's been active on more local environmental issues. Nathan says political activism is important, but
I don't think we'd feel very right about touting this climate action and advocacy if we weren't actually doing anything here. You know, you got to walk the walk, too.
Which is why more and more resorts are trying to green their own operations. At A-Basin, for example, Nathan oversees several energy-efficient buildings and a waste reduction program. He says it saves money, but it's also about setting an example.
If some guest that skied here on a Saturday goes home and puts a compost bucket under their sink, I'm super happy.
He says they do sometimes get pushback.
We'll have a Facebook post around some sustainability win or a new project or an event or something. And there's always like one person that's like, oh, pfft. Great. A-Basin's political now. I guess I won't come. And then like 100 people jump on their back. We don't even have to say anything. They come to our defense.
Christian Knapp with Aspen Skiing Company echoes this sentiment.
I think more and more, you know, certainly millennial generation like to align themselves with businesses and brands that speak to their personal values.
Values like environmental sustainability. He points to companies like Patagonia.
They're basically an activist company. More than ever, and their sales are at record-setting levels. Nike saw a 30% increase in their e-commerce sales the week after the Colin Kaepernick ad campaign broke.
In other words, he says, taking a stand politically on climate change can also help a ski company's bottom line.
We do hope it does have a halo effect on our brand.
They'll see just how much as the current ski season gets underway. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Allie Budner.
That's it for this edition of The Modern West, and we'll have a new episode for you next month. In the meantime, you can find more stories and episodes at our website, themodernwest.org. David Graff produced the episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.